So the title is Way Beyond the Standard Model. In the last 3 years, there has been a big inflation of possibilities for model building. The parameter space has expanded in the case of the radius of new dimensions by a factor of 10 to the 32, and the string scale by a factor of 10 to the 16. As a result, there has been a variety of theoretical scenarios that have been proposed. New mechanisms in the bulk for understanding some aspects of nature, small numbers, cosmology, etc. And there has been a plethora of new phenomena potentially accessible at energy scales between a millimeter and a TeV. In the most extreme case, there is now the possibility that there is just one fundamental scale in nature, the electroweak scale, and everything else is derived. What I'm going to be talking about is essentially an example of each of these occurrences as an example of a new theoretical framework. I'll talk about little string theories at a TeV. As an example of a new mechanism, I'll talk about small numbers from tunneling. As an example of new phenomena potentially accessible in the lab, I'll talk about black holes at LHC. And finally, to please the organizers, I will have to mumble some profundities about the future. Before the proper part of my talk, I want to begin with a quiz. Imagine the following now. It's 2006. This is not hard to imagine. LHC is on. Hopefully not hard to imagine. A bit harder to imagine. TeV gravity is correct. Just assume that. We don't know it yet. Question that I would like to ask you is, what will be the very first experimental indication of black holes? At the very end, I will try to answer, at least I will think of an answer to this question. I encourage you to think about it because you may find a better answer than me. So let me briefly talk about little string theory. And the motivation comes from this formula. The main problem we want to understand, one of the problems we want to understand in nature, is the enormity of the Planck mass. And so far there has been, until recently, two possibilities. One has a string coupling of order one and postulates that both the string scale and the large and the extra dimensions are all at the Planck scale. In the last 3 years, there has been another possibility which also has the string coupling of order one. The string scale is small, and to compensate for this, the volume of the extra dimensions is huge, between a nuclear size and a millimeter. And there is a priori a third possibility that I would like to comment on today, that there is only one fundamental scale in nature, that both the string scale and the size of the extra dimensions are at a TeV, and this dimensionless number is responsible for the enormity of the observed Planck scale. Now, the first problem that this idea has to face is, how come if the string coupling is so small, the gauge coupling is, the gauge couplings of nature are of order one? This is not difficult to do when you have theories on NS5 brains. So here are the four dimensions transverse to the NS5 brain. Here are two extra dimensions parallel to the NS5 brain. If you compactify them on a torus, then the gauge couplings are related to the sizes of these compact dimensions. Okay? And depending on the type of string theory, the particles that you obtain are either zero brains that are endpoints of these strings, or charged strings that are endlines of these two-dimensional surfaces when and they have a characteristic tension. Yeah. In addition, you can have closed strings in the vicinity of five brains, which have a characteristic coupling. Now, as far as the TeV signatures of these theories are concerned, first, because you have extra dimensions at the TEV scale, you have associated Kaluza-Klein and winding modes. You also have string vibrations. In the case of charged strings, you have string vibrations with some characteristic tension, string vibrations of ordinary particles. You have little string vibrations, which in general can have different tension. And finally, you have no strong gravity at the TEV. In fact, strong gravity doesn't come into these theories in an experimentally accessible energy range. It goes up to 10,000 TeV. And there is lots of theoretical issues you can discuss. I don't have time to discuss many of them. You can discuss the stability of the hierarchy or the stabilization of the dilaton. So it's possible, for example, to imagine that the smallness of the string coupling is can be obtained in such a framework by inducing a Coleman-Weinberg type potential for the dilaton by introducing some non-trivial dynamics on a deep brain. For today, I want to talk about something that I find a little more interesting than these canonical ideas, namely the possibility that the dilaton is fixed without a potential, which goes back to very early ideas of Damur and Polyakov. Okay? Damur and Polyakov, apparently motivated by the cosmological constant problem, postulate that the dilaton has no potential, and then they ask themselves the question, under what condition can the dilaton be fixed cosmologically? So they write a general set of interactions. Here is a gauge invariant part of the Lagrangian, say, of the standard model, a gauge invariant term. And Fn is a function that depends on this gauge invariant term, that depends on the dilaton. Okay? And they studied conditions under which the dilaton field is fixed cosmologically. And a necessary condition that the dilaton field is fixed is that all of these different functions, Fn, have one and the same extremum, which a priori appears implausible. And at least to my mind, that terminated my interest in these theories that were proposed in around 94. Now, when you have theories in NS5 brains, this hypothesis seems more natural because for these theories in the string frame, the matter part of the Lagrangian does not depend on G-string, as we mentioned before. And so the dilaton dependence enters in the gravitational parts of the action. So when you go to the Einstein frame, you obtain a conformally coupled matter with a characteristic function f. Okay. Now, it turns out, and this is extremely interesting, that if f of phi has a minimum, then the cosmological evolution, the normal evolution of the universe, drives phi to the minimum of f. And the way to see this is very simple. The equation obeyed by the phi is the same as the equation of a pendulum in honey, or a damped oscillator, with a time-dependent force. Okay. So here is the Hubble friction that is felt by every particle. And on the right-hand side, you have a time-dependent force that depends on two things. First, it depends on the slope of this function f that characterizes the coupling of the dilaton to mass. And second, it depends on the trace of the energy momentum tensor. So you can see from this equation that the following thing happens. If you are not at an extremum of this function f, so this first term doesn't vanish, then the dilaton may or may not feels a force any time the trace of the energy momentum tensor is non-zero, and does not when it's zero. So for example, what Damur and Nordwirth and Damur and Polyakov did is study the implication for the time evolution of the dilaton from this equation, taking into consideration that the universe, as it evolves, sometimes it's radiation dominated, so the trace vanishes, and sometimes it's either matter or inflation dominated, so the trace doesn't vanish. And what happens is the following. Any time you're in a radiation dominated era, This is like a pendulum in honey with vanishing gravitational field of the Earth. Okay, so it's just stuck there. Anytime you go through, let's say, a threshold, a mass threshold, so temporarily the universe becomes matter-dominated, or recently, from about 10,000 years until 10 billion years, the age of the universe today, when the universe is matter-dominated, there is a force term on the right-hand side, which is like turning on the gravitational field of the Earth for this pendulum. Now, if the gravitational field that turns on is large enough, then this oscillator becomes underdamped, so it starts oscillating and converging towards its natural minimum. So using these ideas, they quantitatively estimated if phi starts out at some early epoch being order one away from its minimum, as it goes through the history of all the thresholds, TT bar, BB bar, E plus E minus of the universe, when scale invariance is broken, as well as in the recent epoch from 10,000 years to 10 billion years, how much the dilaton is attracted towards its minimum. Okay, and they found, of course, this is a somewhat model-dependent statement. They found that there is a significant amount of attraction of the dilaton towards its minimum. In particular, if you start this equation, if there is any period of inflation, perhaps early or late, then there is a huge contribution from the right-hand side of the of this forcing term that forces the dilaton practically to its minimum very effectively. Okay. So that's the first conclusion that I'm just repeating here. So in a theory with a conformally coupled dilaton, the cosmological evolution drives you to the minimum of this coupling function F very efficiently. Now, if you are exactly at the minimum, precisely at the minimum, then the dilaton doesn't mediate any 1 over r square force, because right at the minimum, this coupling function of the dilaton to mass, of course, starts out being quadratic, so particles can only interact by 2 dilaton exchanges. There is no single dilaton exchange force. So, and this is adequately small, so that there is no problem with having such a such a massless particle. There is no long-range force problem. However, if the dilaton is in this red position, just a little bit off its minimum, then of course there is a linear term in the expansion of this coupling function, and then there is a 1 dilaton exchange force, which is proportional to this quantity alpha that depends on the amount by which the dilaton is off its minimum. Okay? So known experiments that tell you how well gravity works, tensor theory of gravity works, can put a limit on this quantity alpha squared. Okay? And okay, because first of all, the limits on such a coupling are not so severe, because all the massive particles in the universe couple universally from this scalar particle exchange, so there is no obvious violation, direct violations of equivalence principle. However, this scalar doesn't couple to photons, so there is some differentiation between photons and massive matter. And there is a bunch of constraints or potential tests, if any of these constraints gets, if any of these things get measured very precisely. They come from a variety of things, Big Bang nucleosynthesis, all kinds of time delay of light signals, all kinds of physics. It turns out that the most stringent constraint comes from Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And the reason for this is the following. If during Big Bang nucleosynthesis, the value of this quantity that measures how far off you are from the minimum cannot be more than 10% or so. The reason is the following. If it's more than 10% off, then this would correspond to, well, depending on the frame in which you work, either the Planck mass being different during nucleosynthesis than now, or if you wish, the masses of elementary particles being different. If you work on the Einstein frame, the mass of the elementary particles are different during nucleosynthesis and now. This, because nucleosynthesis works to within about 10%, therefore, this mismatch cannot be more than about 10%. This quantity, alpha squared, cannot be more than 10% at the time of nucleosynthesis. Okay, but between nucleosynthesis and now, because of tendency of the dilaton to go towards its minimum by virtue of some scale non-invariant era in the history of the universe, if alpha squared started out being 10%, then by today it will go down to about 10 to minus 4. So the biggest constraint comes from Big Bang nucleosynthesis, and I feel it's very solid. Essentially, it depends mostly on helium-4 abundance. If the universe expands, let's say, a little more rapidly, by 10%, then there is less time for neutrons to go into protons. So there is bigger helium-4 abundance by roughly 10%. Because there is now more neutrons left over to combine with the protons and form helium-4. So it depends on bare minimum amount of information from the Big Bang, namely helium-4 abundance. So I feel this is a fairly solid limit on alpha squared. Future prospects, many of these things may be improved. In particular, in 2002, there is going to be GPB going in space. This is the famous gravity probe B, or relativistic gyro experiment. You'll have two gyroscopes going around the Earth on a polar orbit, and you'll study the behavior of the gyroscopes. It's a good test of the spin-2 nature of the Einstein theory. So if there is some additional scalar admixture, it will be sensitive to that. And that's the estimate for alpha squared, for the degree by which the dilaton is off the minimum. A challenge for these theories, I'm not sure how challenging it is, I just don't know how intensely people thought about this, is to understand why in this coupling function, f of phi, this mass coupling function, why should it have the form to favor a large expectation value for the dilaton, so as to explain why G-string itself is small. Perhaps there is an analog of the Coleman-Weinberg type phenomenon for the function phi, just like it happens for a normal four-dimensional potential. But this is an open problem before these ideas will be even more interesting. This is an open problem. So these are some of the macroscopic potential PV signatures and macroscopic signatures of these theories with tiny string couplings. These theories also point to one more possibility for answering the following question. Imagine that in our favorite year, 2006, LHC discovers TeV-sized dimensions. Okay. Now, because now these theories are higher dimensional, there is a natural question of how do you complete them? What's a consistent ultraviolet completion of such theories? One possibility is, of course, that you have full string theory at a TV, which is the simplest possibility, since it would say that there is just one scale in nature. But now there is another possibility. Maybe you have little string theory at a TV. Yet, another possibility that I believe Nima must have talked about in the first day is that you have an extremely, the TV dimension is not actually a dimension, it's just an extremely long mousse of a sequence of gauge groups that come back onto themselves, and you just see, if you wish, Goldstone waves or waves moving around this mousse instead of a higher dimension. And that's another nice possibility, which would imply that if you go to still higher energies, let's say 10 or 100 TeV, you'll go back to a four-dimensional theory with several gauge groups. Now I want to move to the second topic. which is small numbers from tunneling. Now, most of the numbers in nature turned out to be small. We don't really understand why. For example, if you look at the standard model, only four numbers make any sense. The three gauge coupling and the top Yukawa coupling. Everything else is weird. It's small for a reason that we don't understand. If you go to the supersymmetric standard model, the situation is even more severe. Roughly over 100 small, there is now over 100 small parameters. If any one of them was not adequately small, you would have gigantic flavor violations and all kinds of undesirable processes would be mediated. Now, in the standard desert framework that has been with us since the early 70s, to explain small numbers, basically explain small numbers by essentially energy denominators. If you separate phenomena in energy space, then you can account for the smallness as being a consequence of this energy separation. This is, for example, why gravity is weak, why proton is long-lived, neutrino masses are small. It all comes from separation in energy space. This idea can be repeated with little change in the bulk framework. If you want to explain small numbers, you have to separate the phenomena or the origins of phenomena in position space. So this is the bulk, this big sphere is the bulk. Here is where we live, us, right here at this corner. And the graviton, or if you wish the right-handed neutrino, are particles that move all over the bulk. So because their wave function is smeared throughout the bulk, they very rarely interact with us, and that explains the weakness of gravity or the smallness of neutrino mass. Or if you wish to explain the smallness of the approximate conservation, approximate symmetries, you can explain them by arguing that the origin of the violation of these symmetries starts at some faraway place, maybe a millimeter away, into the bulk. Now, there is another possibility for understanding small numbers. So far, we've been talking as if we have some sort of dilute gas of three brains embedded in this in the big bulk. Another possibility is that you may have a dense gas. Okay, so dense that occasionally several brains coincide to approximately the same location and they significantly distort the geometry. Okay. Okay. So, for example, so this profile, this Bruff profile, you can think of this Bruff profile being as the profile of the geometry, which creates tunneling barriers to particle to degrees of freedom that reside in the bulk. For example, if you consider two observers, one purple observer here and another observer there, it's a time-dependent intensity. Okay. So let's say we are out here, and here is another another observer. Say that violation of, let's say, the origin of any of the approximate symmetries that we observe, such as baryon number or supersymmetry or neutrino chirality or electron chirality, the origin of the smallness by which they are violated can be again blamed to the fact that the origin of this violation and us are separated by some potential barrier. That's great. Thank you. Okay. Now, so this says that to understand, in such a setup, to understand the smallness of various, the degree, quantitatively, the degree of smallness of various violations, we would have to work out a multidimensional tunneling problem. So instead of doing that as just toy examples, it's simpler to just work out a one-dimensional toy model, where here what we are doing, we are patching together, let's say, two warped geometries. Here is a UV brain. Here is a left IR and a right IR brain. And just like before, if you have some degrees of freedom on the left and on the right to communicate between them, you have to penetrate this gravitational barrier. Okay. Now, first application of this idea is essentially identical to Gamow's alpha decay calculation. Let's say that, okay, so again, here you are patching together two ADS spaces. This is, let's say you have some excitation here of mass m, and you want to ask the question, let's say we live here, if you want to imagine, this could be, for example, let's say a TeV brain, we live here, this is a TeV mass particle, and you have another brain on the right that can be very far away. This distance, the right brain can be very, very far away. The corresponding length scale on this right brain can be perhaps kiloparsecs or megaparsecs, some really big scale. Okay? So ask the question, what's the tunneling rate for this particle to decay from the left to the right, and the calculation tells you that it goes like the fifth power of the mass times the ADS radius to the fourth. Now this formula has the following interesting, two interesting things. One is independent of this formula. First interesting thing, the first statement I want to remind you of is independent of this formula. A general statement is that TeV mass particles that have a conservation law, so they can only disappear from the universe by annihilating with each other, okay? They don't disappear in isolation, but they can only disappear by in association, by annihilating. Then if such particles have TeV, order TeV mass, then they have just the right abundance to close the universe. So this is a well-known coincidence. It accounts, for example, for the statement of why particles in supersymmetric theories are natural candidates for cold dark matter, for closing the universe. And this TeV, incidentally, has nothing to do with the electroweak scale, with the W mass. This would be TeV even if the W mass was zero. This TeV comes because TeV is the geometric mean of 3 degrees Kelvin and M Planck. And that turns out to be the right mass to critically close the universe. And it would be there even if we didn't have electroweak symmetry breaking. Okay. Second coincidence that depends on this formula, of course, is that if you take this formula and you plug in an ADS radius of M gut, then the lifetime for this particle turns out to be 10 billion years, which is the age of the universe. So this opens the fascinating possibility that dark matter of the universe can be made out of TeV matter that is today decaying decaying. And depending on the location of this right brain, if the right brain is very, very, very far away, it could be decaying into essentially conformal field theory matter. So this answers a fascinating question that many people had asked, can most of the mass of the universe be in CFT matter? And the answer, of course, to start with is not always. In other words, it cannot be the case that CFT matter dominated the energetics of the universe from time zero to now. In particular, we know from structure formation, to form structure at small length scales, you need to have cold dark matter, non-relativistic matter dominate the energetics of the universe between about 10,000 years and today, or within an order of magnitude of today. Okay? And of course the previous discussion illustrates the new possibility that in fact the cold dark matter today may be decaying to conformal or approximately conformal matter. And this may have implications for softening the profiles of dark matter mass distribution in either galaxies or clusters. This is, depending on who the astrophysicist that you talk to, you will be told that this is or is not a problem of cold dark matter theory. cold dark matter simulations give rise to a lot of spikiness, clumpiness in either galactic scales or galactic cluster scales. The absence, for example, of satellite galaxies associated in clusters, in satellite galaxies associated with our own or other galaxies, as well as the absence of excessive cluspiness, some people believe is evidence against the pure cold dark matter framework. And people from several years ago suggested all kinds of possible resolutions of this problem, including decaying dark matter. This is nothing more than one version of decaying dark matter that is somewhat appealing because the final state is conformal matter. Another application of this idea, again, you can imagine several applications that can give you small numbers. Imagine, as an example of a small number, supersymmetry breaking. So this is the same setup. This is the gut brain, the characteristic scale 10 to the 16 GeV. This is Planck. And let's say we have on the right some other brain. We live, of course, on the left on the gut brain, and there is another brain where the breaking of supersymmetry originates. Okay, originates here, and then it's communicated through tunneling to us. Now, if you could make such a scenario work, of course, you could understand the smallness of supersymmetry breaking on the left as a result of tunneling suppression. Furthermore, because the scale, the characteristic scale, because the characteristic scale on the gut brain is the gut scale, you could have pretty ordinary physics from zero energy all the way up to the gut scale. So you could, for example, reproduce unification of couplings in the same way as normal supersymmetric theories. Furthermore, there is one version of this scenario where you can naturally implement what are called, what I believe are called no-scale initial conditions. Although, well, I don't know what people mean by no-scale. That's what I mean by no-scale. The Gugino mass is non-zero, but the squark and the scalar masses are zero at mgut, at the gut scale. And subsequently, all the squark masses are induced by gauge interactions, at least, so the squark gets a mass through coupling to Gugino and a quark. And to start with, this is definitely good news because of, since it's gauge forces that mediate this diagram, all the squarks would get the same mass. Okay. So why this is good? Well, this goes back to what is called the very famous problem of many versions of supersymmetric theories, most, which is called the supersymmetric flavor problem. So here is a pictorial way of understanding the supersymmetric flavor problem. Imagine that the plane of the transparency is what's called the flavor, or the flavor group, U3 to the fifth. Three because there are three families to the fifth. Five comes because there are five species of particles in each family. So U3 to the fifth is called the flavor group. And imagine this plane, the plane of the transparency, is the flavor group. Now you can represent mass square matrices, let's say of squarks or sleptons or right-handed squarks, as with ellipsoids. These are 3x3 mass matrices, mass square matrices. Represent them by ellipsoids, each one of whose axis corresponds to the eigenvalue of this ellipsoid. Then, because fermion, the fermion mass spectrum for both the up quarks and the down quarks has one very big eigenvalue and the other ones are much smaller, then we are essentially representing them by arrows, very elongated ellipsoids. And when two ellipsoids is parallel in this space, then we interpret them to commute, okay? Parallel ellipsoids means that the corresponding 3x3 mass square matrix is commute. So in this picture, here is the up quark mass square matrix, here is the down, and the misalignment tells you about the degree to which they fail to commute, and it's the famous Kabibo-Kobayashi-Maskawa angle. Okay. Now, if all of the squark masses are degenerate, then the squark masses are a sphere in this U3 to the fifth flavor space. And because a sphere doesn't choose any direction in space, it does not induce any new flavor violations. There is no new flavor violations associated with any mismatch between the up and the down matrix. Now, a problem that happens that very frequently in supersymmetric theories, unfortunately including the one that I'm talking about, is the following. If the origin of supersymmetry breaking, if the soft masses do not vanish significantly below the grand unification or the Planck scale, then whatever physics gives differentiates quarks from each other, namely breaks flavor, will also distort the shape of the squark masses. So you'll end up with an ellipsoidal shape which does choose a given direction in space, and as a result has new physical angles, those that rotate quarks into squarks. And those physical angles can give to rise to disastrous processes, KK bar mixing, DD bar, for the case of leptons, mu goes to E gamma. Now this is what typically happens in what is called gravity-mediated theories. The one that I described here, this, if you wish, within its no-scale boundary conditions, I believe the same thing happens. Although the squark masses are zero right at the gut scale, and you cannot, so zero means that they are a point in this diagram, and you cannot distort a point right in the middle. If you go one order of magnitude, say, below the gut scale, they have a non-trivial magnitude, and then they can be distorted by gut or Planck scale flavor physics. So in general, I believe the framework I described to you would suffer from this problem. So to avoid it, typically one has to go to what are called low-scale GH mediation theories, where Planckian physics cannot distort the squark masses. Now, all of you had time to think about the quiz that I assigned, so I'll tell you a candidate answer to the quiz, and in the discussion session you may think of better ways to discover black holes at the Large Hadron Collider if the fundamental gravity scale is about a TeV. Okay, so this is some black hole lore. If the impact parameter between the two beams, two partonic beams at LHC is less than Schwarzschild, then you expect that a black hole will form. So here is the cross section. You can compute the Schwarzschild radius going back to the argument of Laplace. And here is the cross section where G Newton is the higher dimensional Planck scale. Now, if everything is roughly a TeV, of course the cross-section will be of the order of TeV, and there will not be any intrinsically small couplings. This is somewhat amusing because normally when you produce, say, new particles, you have you pay price like a coupling constant price, and here the cross-section is just the characteristic scale of the whole problem if the fundamental scale is around the TeV. Now, what does this mean in terms of numbers? Now, here is the expected integrated LHC luminosity for integrated over 3 years will be 100 inverse femtobonds. Now, if you multiply this times the cross-section, you find the number of black holes that will be produced in 3 years at LHC. Now, this is 40 million black holes. This is an astonishing number. Okay, just remember that the Z particle that allowed you to do high precision electroweak physics for a decade, you had a few million Zs, and here you have 40 million. Okay, this is of course in the maximally good case where the scale is a TeV, but even if it's 10 TeV, you'll still have 400,000 black holes. So there is no question of statistics here. The question is background. What is the background to black holes? In particular, background means, is the decay signal of the black hole distinctive enough to keep it separate from standard model, or perhaps even supersymmetric backgrounds, if supersymmetry comes at the same place. Okay, so here are some characteristics. The most important one, pointed out by Empar and Horovitz and Mears, and missed by myself and many people, is that the black holes decay on the brain. That's very important. so that you don't lose, most of the energy goes on the brain. Okay, there's a continuum spectrum of black holes. Another feature that's unique, the heavier, the cooler, and that's how its temperature depends on its mass. E or M is the mass of the black hole. Multiplicity, here is how the multiplicity, how many decay products does it decay into? And now we come to flavor, okay? In other words, what does it decay into? Now, I have no idea what it decays into, in particular because these are very low mass black holes, very near the string scale. So I'm not even sure, they're more stringy objects than they are black holey, because they are so light, they're right at, so I don't really know what they decay into. However, it seems reasonable to believe that they decay roughly democratically. And if you assume that, then you can do very simple counting of what you expect them to decay into. Again, at the zeroth order level, okay, there are 59 particles in the standard model, okay, three families, 12 gauge bosons and two Higgses, okay? And then six of these are charged leptons, there is some neutrinos, some, in other words, so 10% of the particles are charged leptons, and there is some invisible energy, but not excessive. Okay, although experimentalists can deal with much more invisible energy, but this is not excessive. And so here is my candidate answer to the question that I asked in the beginning. I think the main signature for a black hole production will be hard primary leptons in a hadronic machine at the Large Hadron Collider. So for example, if let's say the mass divided by the temperature of the black hole is 4, just to give a number, then typically the black hole will decay into 4 particles, and a significant fraction of the time you'll have energetic leptons with a quarter of the energy, several hundred GeV. This is very hard to reproduce with standard model or supersymmetric standard model backgrounds. Typically, you produce leptons as a result of cascades, so they tend to be softer, okay, so you don't get typically hard primary leptons. I think the background out of this is going to be very small, and an experimentalist friend of mine, Greg Landsberg, is working the details of these signatures. There's also going to be, of course, hard primary jets. Of course, these are the smoking guns. The ultimate smoking cannon will be to confirm the relation between mass and temperature or average energy and multiplicity as predicted by, you know, the higher dimensional or n-dimensional or higher dimensional Hawking formula. Okay? And this, according to my experimentalist friends, can be done easily. You measure what's called the transverse energy, and then from that you can reconstruct with that little amount of missing energy, you can reliably reconstruct mass. And
that's an exception of the cosmic rays, that we get energy is much larger than the irradiation.
Oh yeah, no, the problem with cosmic rays is not the energy, it's the flux. So there is such little flux in cosmic rays that what you do observe is QCD, peripheral processes with transfers, momentum transfer of 100 MeV.
You get half this to 10 to 21 electron volts to make a cascade in the atmosphere.
That's right, but that's a sequence of many soft processes. There is no one hard process. It's a sequence of many QCD processes. That's why we need accelerators. We need accelerators for the flux more than we need them for the energy, in fact. Energies you can get in cosmic rays. Okay, so that's my... So hard primary leptons and photons are a possible early signal of black holes. Okay, so now before we get into the... Okay, that's plenty. Before we get into the vision discussion, I want to discuss one more thing as a theoretical challenge. This is not... definitely not a visionary thing. It is just something that many of my friends find as an interesting problem. So, construct a string model. I should say from the beginning, it may be that what I'm going to present as a challenge actually has already been done, and I just am not familiar with the literature. That's quite likely. So please tell me if you think this has been done. But here is something that I would like to see. Okay? Construct a string model, any scale, we don't care, high, low, intermediate, doesn't matter, with the following properties. First, okay, very modest, realistic particle spectrum, three chiral families and all the other good things, unification prediction, and the emphasis is on the word prediction, okay? Not to accommodate the gauge couplings that we observe in nature, but to be able to predict one in terms of the other two. Okay? And no obvious disasters. No humongous proton decay, no big lepton violations, flavor, NN bar oscillations, to within reason. Okay? Well, this sounds extremely difficult, so to make it easy, do not worry about supersymmetry breaking at all. The reason why I personally believe that worrying about supersymmetry breaking is totally premature, I've been thinking that for 20 years, because unless you solve the cosmological constant problem, nobody is going to believe any theory of supersymmetry breaking. At least I will not. So, hints. Here are hints for trying to do such a construction. First, the gauge sector should depend on at most two parameters. This is an obvious statement. You want to predicting the gauge coupling, the predicting the unification of couplings means predicting one of the gauge couplings in terms of the other two. So you must have no more than two parameters that fully determine the gauge sector of the theory. Now, in normal unified theories, these two parameters are G-gut and M-gut, okay? The unification mass scale and the value of the common value of the gauge couplings at the unification mass. Now, this is a very big constraint. It implies in particular that you cannot use intermediate scales of gauge symmetry breaking, okay? Or else you'll have too many degrees of freedom. Furthermore, here is another hint that's perhaps a bit less familiar. The only... Okay, here I have to make a definition. The only incomplete SU5 multiplets of your theory must be the normal gauge multiplets, SU3 cross SU2 cross SU1, and the two Higgs multiplets of the supersymmetric standard model. Notice that every other particle in the standard model is a complete multiplet. For example, a family is a complete SU5 multiplet. It's a 10 and a 5 bar of SU5, okay? The only things that are incomplete are gauge or Higgs multiplet. Now, it turns out that the unification of couplings does not care at all about about complete SU5 multiplets. A complete, the three gauge couplings, a complete SU5 multiplet does not distinguish between U1, SU3, and SU2. It's blind towards that distinction because it is complete. And therefore, it does not affect the unification of couplings. You can take, for example, the supersymmetric standard model and add any number of complete SU5 multiplets, you are not going to change the fact that you have unification. The whole success of unification depends on extremely detailed things, namely the Higgs and the gauge incomplete multiplets, the way they come into play. It turns out, in fact, for reasons that are not totally transparent, that the gauge part doesn't play as important a role as the Higgs part. So, for example, if you take the standard model, there is only one Higgs doublet. Incomplete, there is no corresponding color triplet. Okay, standard model has one Higgs doublet, supersymmetric standard model has two Higgs doublets and their superpartners. And this apparently small difference makes a huge difference here, makes the difference between this. This is the amount by which the standard model misses to unify. It, you can't tell from this plot, which is somewhat odd, but it's many, many standard deviations off. And this, which is the famous plot of successful unification. It's an apparently small change. You just add an extra Higgs and its superpartners. But it makes a huge difference, in part because the superpartners are Higgs fermions, so they contribute a lot to the beta function. There is two of them. So, finally, in order not to disappoint the organizers, I have to say something about some visionary remarks. And here is what we've been asked to do. Okay? A huge task that I can definitely not, I cannot live up to this task. Vision of where the field is going, where it should be going. I cannot live up to this task for a very simple reason. I'm no good in predicting just about anything. Okay? And perhaps the most humbling experience that I've had with predictions has to do with a cosmological constant. If one of my colleagues came to me 15 years ago or 10 years ago and told me, you know, the cosmological constant is almost but not quite zero, I would think these are grounds for loss of tenure. And why would the Almighty start at the Planck scale, bring the cosmological constant 120 orders of magnitude and beyond, and not go all the way to zero, or bring it to zero and then kick it a tiny bit by a millimeter up? The whole thing sounds totally silly. Nevertheless, you know the story. However, not to disappoint the organizers, I have to make one firm prediction. One firm prediction. And I sure hope I'm not wrong on this one. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. So, any questions or answers to the quiz or challenges?
I wanted to mention that Scott Thomas and I had also been thinking about your quiz question, and I think that black hole production is relevant both in the kind of scenario that you and Arkani Hamid and Vali discussed, as well as in a number of these warp compactification scenarios, certainly. And surely one of the most stunning implications is that as you crank up the energy, as you go to higher and higher energies, you get both growing cross sections and lifetimes. So these things sort of take over everything if you, say, go to the next accelerator beyond LHC. Also, this signature of thermal distributions together with a few hard particles from the final end stages of the decay seem like they should be quite stunning. And those thermal distributions may well be sensitive to the shape as well as the number of extra dimensions. So those are just a few other related observations.
Any response?
No, this was a statement. Mm-hmm. It was not a question.
I also wanted to make a comment about black hole signals, though I think this may be at not the earliest energies, which is what your question was really about. But I think one important thing is that we're going to see the shutting off of hard QCD processes and other large transverse momentum things, because those are all going to go into black holes and we'll get soft final states instead. I wanted to ask a question about the little string story. My understanding was that the universality in that case was motivated by saying we were at very, very weak string coupling, so we can do the tree level analysis and then there's a universal function there. But isn't it also true that the universal function is an exponential and doesn't have a minimum?
No. This is the challenge. Yeah, let me come back to this. You're right. Let me come to this. Yeah. I'm not going. Okay. So, as you say, okay, so just to connect, so this is the function f, and in general it's given by some expansion, okay? And here we are making a hypothesis if f of phi has a minimum. Now, we don't know how to get a minimum. This challenge that I outline at the bottom of this page has to do with precisely that question. If we could find some mechanism, perhaps similar to Coleman-Weinberg, which would create a large minimum for this function f of phi, then all of this discussion would have validity as it stands. But we haven't answered this question, so I just don't know how to. No. No, the function itself f, okay, here is what we are imagining. Since it hasn't been done, I cannot defend it, okay? I'm imagining something like Coleman-Weinberg, namely some log correction which will lead to a balancing of two terms with the same power of G-string but different powers of log. We haven't done such a thing, so I cannot defend it, but that's what would have to happen to create out of this f of phi a large verb for the dilator. And I don't, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so having large extra dimensions and gravity at the TV scale is one way in which we can have some flavor blind physics, which has lots of degrees of freedom. I mean, we could imagine having like some conformal field theory that is also framework flavor blind, such as the Randall syndrome model or something like that. Now, how one would distinguish between signatures of that type and black holes, how you put all that? So suppose you make a black hole in a Randall syndrome type model, that would be very similar to some excitation in some strongly coupled gauge theory. How would you distinguish whether the radius is large or small? It seems that the prediction you mentioned about 10% leptons would be true for anything that is more or less flavor blind, couples, more or less universally.
That may be. You're saying that different theories with TV scales will have similar signatures. And that may very well be, yeah.
Savas, supposing hypothetically that proton before the year 2006, mm-hmm. proton decay was seen with a lifetime of 10 to the 34 years or whatever, would you agree that that would be suggestive more of a high unification scale than a low unification scale?
You shouldn't worry about what I think, because by 2006, experiment will tell us one way or another. The obvious instinct is to say, well, if it is also, for example, you can make the story increasingly harder for me by telling me, okay, proton decays to kaons and neutrinos. and it has a right lifetime for Suzy Gatch. I think, okay, already gauge coupling unification is one positive thing of the normal supersymmetric framework. Now, proton decay with the right final modes, scans and trinos, would be an additional one. Okay. However, 2006 is not very far. Mm-hmm. So we will not directly.
Okay, thank you very much. So, yes, let's meet again at 3:45. Okay.